the legal advocacy pressure against the apartheid regime. At the moment, the Liberal Resource Centre has two focus areas, the one being land, so dealing with housing addiction and environmental issues, and the other focus area we have at the moment is education. And yeah, so we use our legal skills, trying to get recognition of constitutional rights, engage in litigation and advocacy as well. So yes, we have quite a decent reach throughout the country, but we do not operate internationally. I hope that answers that question. In terms of our role in cases of misconduct in schools, so we do have a program that does look at educator sexual misconduct. We are not the police, so we are not involved in researching or investigating, but we do collect data from different provincial education departments about what they are doing in relation to cases that have been reported to them, how they are managing those cases. We have a free legal clinic, so if a client were to ever come to us saying that an instance of education misconduct occurred to them at the school, then we would assist in representing the learner and ensuring that the proper procedures are followed. But we do not go out soliciting help. Generally, in our experience, school principals aren't that excited to see us when we come to their doors and we say that we're lawyers. And with dealing with children as one at the age of 18, there's lots of permission and red tape that we need to jump through. So generally, we do not go to schools and ask learners if they have had these experiences, but we're more than welcome to assist learners if they do report instances of that nature to us. As part of our advocacy efforts, we also distribute pamphlets around schools and have podcasts and other kind of social media campaigns where learners can, which will assist learners in identifying what an instance of rape is, what sexual harassment is, what is inappropriate conduct on behalf of a teacher, what is appropriate conduct. And through those advocacy efforts, we hope to empower learners so that if an incident were to come up, that they would know what their rights are in that situation, and that they would know that they would be able to contact us for advice if they feel that they need it. So, heading to the third question asked by an honourable member regarding where we stand on matters relating to principals who do not report incidents of education misconduct. We can see that power dynamics at play in schools can be very difficult to navigate, and that often, and because of that reason, often these incidents don't come out to the general public or to staff, for example. As one of the honourable members said, that there's often a practice of protecting friends or colleagues in relation to these incidents. We think that that a provision should be there which says that the principal has a responsibility to report once the issue is being raised with them. In relation to what the consequences of a failure to report or failure to comply with that obligation would be, that is something that we are still doing research on around best practices. But we do think that at the bare minimum, if a provision says that the principal does have this duty, then that would at least put some pressure, and even if it results in another 3 or 4 cases a year ending up being reported to authorities, we think that such a provision would have solved, well, it would have solved the problem, but would have would constitute a step in the right direction. In relation to a question posed by Honourable Member regarding why learners do not have IDs and birth certificates, so we probably get about 5 to 10 children in this position coming to our offices each week, a majority of whom are South African citizens as well, who don't have birth certificates. And I do think that is an important matter to raise. Usually when we think about undocumented children, we think, or undocumented people in general, we think of foreigners. And that was definitely my impression before starting legal practice. But I can confidently say that most of the undocumented children or people that we deal with are South African citizens. The majority of them do not have documentation due to obstacles which they encounter at the Department of Home Affairs. So recently, the Legal Resources Center was 2 years ago. We litigated on the issue where Home Affairs was not allowing unmarried fathers to register the births of their children. There's still some issues that that are present in that regard, where Home Affairs makes lots of obstacles relating to paternity tests, traveling there, traveling here, social worker requirements, and keep on adding a new requirement until it comes to a point where a father just gives up because the birth of their child cannot be registered. A lot of the time, the parents are alive but are not in the picture. And Home Affairs will say that a death certificate must be accompanied for the birth to be registered, failing which the parent himself must come to the office, but parents refuse to do so. So there are lots of issues that arise at Home Affairs, especially in relation to unmarried fathers. They seem to have the biggest hurdle due to Home Affairs having fears around child trafficking or like people claiming children who are not theirs. And that has resulted in many, many South African children not having birth certificates. So on that question, why learners do not have IDs and birth certificates, it's mainly around that issue of procedures at Home Affairs frustrating the process. And the Legal Resources Center is currently litigating on a number of those issues to make it easier for South Africans without birth certificates to get them. Undocumented asylum seekers as well, fleeing their countries due to war, for example, generally did not take their birth certificates or generally do not have any documentation with them when they enter our border. And that is another subgroup of people who we assist. Honourable Members asked a question regarding the teacher-learner relationship, if they are at different schools, and how that can be established for the purposes of triggering the application of the Employment of Educators Act. So our primary concern here is that educators will not face the penalties and the sanctions that are present under Section 17 of the Employment of Educators Act, for example, if the learner is at another school, and we feel as though the same sanctions should apply to them. Whether that relationship between an educator and a learner of another school can actually be established would be a factual question, and it is conceded that it will definitely be easier to establish such a relationship if the educator and learner are on the same school. Our submission is that in cases where it can be established and in cases where it is clear, the provisions of the Employment of Educators Act should kick in so that the educator is not allowed to freely move in between schools and to perpetuate inappropriate relations, inappropriate behavior with students. In relation to questions surrounding the National Intergovernmental Committee and the Provincial Intergovernmental Committee, we are aware, I do not have my constitution with me now, but we are aware that the constitution encourages and facilitates intergovernmental cooperation between different governmental departments, for example. However, our primary concern here is the privacy considerations which arise. So, for example, in section 34 of COPIA, it is said that a responsible party may not process personal information concerning a child, subject to some exceptions contained in section 35. I do not have time to go through all of those exceptions, but it is our submission that none of those exceptions would apply. And for the private information to be processed of children, learners or children, by these different governmental organizations or different governmental departments would constitute a violation of Section 34 of COPIA. And if this were to go ahead, perhaps an amendment to COPIA would be necessary. But in our opinion, there is a clear conflict as things stand. Okay, there was a question asked about what programs that the LRC has to help parents obtain documents. We often write letters to Department of Home Affairs officials. We have working relationships with a number of office managers at Department of Home Affairs offices in the Western Cape and other provinces that we operate in. And it is in communication with them because sometimes Home Affairs officials are unclear on how exactly a legal provision should be interpreted. So it's through that kind of engagement that we assist parents in obtaining documents. The question received from the chair dealing with undocumented kids, the question asked why the issue of embassies are not referred to in our submissions about different organizations, bodies, departments which can assist undocumented kids. So my first answer would be that majority of those documented children that we encounter are South Africans, so going to an embassy would not help. Secondly, I would like to say that in terms of the Refugees Act in South Africa, if you are an asylum seeker or if you're a refugee, you cannot avail yourselves to your host country's government. The implication of that provision meaning that an asylum seeker or a refugee cannot go to the embassy that their country has in South Africa for any kind of assistance. Because if they were to do so, their asylum seeker status or their refugee status would be withdrawn. So it is for that reason that we do not mention embassies or consulates as a potential option for foreign undocumented children to go to in order to obtain documentation. Question received from the chair as well with respect to our motivation around advocating for undocumented children I'm assuming that it relates to both foreign and local undocumented children. We've seen throughout the years in our work that not having documents as a child can affect our hopes of rights. It can frustrate getting access to SASA grants, for example, can frustrate getting admission to university. We have some South African clients in their 20s who do not have documents and they cannot open bank accounts, for example, because, yes, they don't have an ID. So we try our best to ensure that individuals who are entitled to documents get them. And as I said earlier, we are currently litigating to ensure that the process is facilitated, because often the reason why a child is undocumented has nothing to do with their own behavior, but either their parents' behavior or Home Affairs behavior. With respect to the definition of educator in the Employment Act, it is true that the terms teacher and educator are clearly defined in the Act, and speak to, or the way that they are currently defined speaks to educators who've been trained, trained to teach children. And therefore, the submissions we have made with respect to regulating non-teaching staff in schools does not cleanly or does not smoothly fit within the ambit of the Employment of Educators Act. That being said, anecdotally, it has come to our attention that rugby coaches, water polo coaches, gardeners, cleaners have been involved in cases of serious misconduct involving learners, and therefore we believe that there needs to be somewhere in the law that addresses this issue. It could be that this committee decides that a new piece of legislation should be promulgated to deal with this subset of employees. However, due to the fact that Employment of Educators Act already deals with and defines instances of misconduct and serious misconduct, we think that it may be most convenient for this committee and the quickest way to address the problem would be to include in the definitions that the term educator applies to non-teaching staff, at least in respect of Section 18 and 17 of the Employment of Educators Act. With respect to whether the LRC communicated with the South African Council of Educators in relation to the recommendations that we have made before this committee today, we have not done so. We are primarily in consultation with schools themselves in the existing network that we have. A point was made from an honourable member regarding unconditional admission and the hypothetical scenario in terms of which a child could go jumping from one school to the next every 2 days without documents, without any form of identification, and would be entitled to be educated. So the unconditional admission that we're referring to today in this council, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify myself, is unconditional admission in relation to the absence of documentation. Obviously, there will be a number, well, perhaps not so obviously, but there can be a number of instances where a school can decide not to admit a learner. For example, if the school is overcrowded, if the learner has a criminal record, for example, if there's other kind of compelling reason why a learner should not be admitted to the school. That being said, we submit that when it comes to the issue of documentation, it should never be a reason why a child is rejected from school. This is because of the constitutional provision, which I'm sure as a member of the committee you're quite familiar with, which says that everyone in South Africa is entitled to basic education. And this has been reaffirmed by our courts in a number of times, and especially in relation to documentation. So it's our submission that requiring or leaving ambiguity around the requirement of documents would be in conflict of the Centre for Child Law case of 2019. A question was asked about by an honourable member concerning relationships between educators and children, and learners who are above the age of 18, and how that dynamic can be navigated, can be addressed by Bella. So, in a situation of consensual sex between an educator and a learner above the age of 18, that conduct does not constitute a crime in terms of the crime law, the criminal laws of South Africa. However, the conduct can still be regulated in terms of Bella. Bella does not have to render or to deem such conduct to be a crime. However, Bella can impose certain consequences on the educator for engaging in such conduct. Why Bella should impose sanctions in such situations is that even though a learner may be above the age of 18, there's still a power imbalance that will exist between the learner and the educator concerned. And for example, I can't think of a recent case, but at least anecdotally, I think that most of us have heard of instances where learners are exchanging sex for marks, for example. So even though the learner may be about the age of 18 and be a major, some kind of sanction needs to be imposed by Bella to say that a crime has not been committed, but there's going to be an investigation to see if there's any kind of quid pro quo going on in terms of this relationship, and if so, whether any further sanction is necessary. In relation to the codes of conduct and transgender learners, I am pleased to say that I agree with the honourable members when he said that issues relating to race, gender, do not have a place within the code of conduct and should be addressed in another kind of, I guess, documents governing school rules. However, in our experience, these issues often crop up in codes of conduct, perhaps in an indirect or more subtle way. An example that I can provide is that a code of conduct would say that during summer, boys must wear blue shorts and white t-shirts, and girls must wear blue skirts and white shirts. On the face of it, that is not dealing with anything related to transgender learners, for example. But what often happens is that a provision which says girls wear skirts and shirts during the summer is often interpreted by school bodies as saying that every learner who has an S on their birth certificate next to what sex they are must wear a skirt and a shirt, and everybody has an M on their birth certificate next to their sex must wear shorts and shirts. And it says these kinds of provisions within codes of conduct that transgender learners, for example, would need to need to apply for an exemption from under the proviso that they can illustrate just cause. Generally, the Legal Resources Center does not have an issue with the just cause provision, provided that more substance is provided to it. As things stand now, the just cause requirement or exemption is so broad as to provide unfettered discretion to the school governing body or to the principal concerned, whereas if more substance was given to it, perhaps saying that one of the factors that must be considered are the gender diversity or the racial diversity of the school, or constitutional values, for example, that would provide greater guidance to ensure that that term, just cause, is not abused by school governing bodies or principals to marginalize transgender learners, for example. But I'm sure that there are other instances where a certain ideology, a certain perspective can be used to give meaning to just cause, which would be anti-transformation or exclusionary. In issues relating to false accusations, false accusations of rape, I think that the example provided by the Honourable Member was when a learner who's vindictive for some reason accuses an educator of rape. I'd just like to thank the Honourable Member, because I don't think that such a hypothetical example is outside the realm of possibility from what we've seen. So this is a very tricky issue. And we're actually not sure whether Bella would be the best place to address it. As has been happening recently in the university space, to accuse somebody of rape falsely, and if that leads to any kind of reputational harm or financial damages, for example, if somebody to get fired from their job, there's already, there's already a legal remedy for instances like that in our law of delict. And the legal remedy would be a cause of action which is called defamation. And we think that in instances where an educator thinks that they have been falsely accused and they have suffered either reputational harm or financial harm in any way, they are able to use the laws of delict as defamation and approach the courts in that fashion. Something that perhaps FACE would want to consider is to intervening as a professional body and assisting educators in instances of false accusations, and to educate educators of the rights which they have in those kind of circumstances. But as far as bail is applicable, we think that such issues are adequately covered in other areas of the law. If you'll give me a moment, Chair, I just want to make sure that I've addressed what I needed to, or what has been asked. Thank you, Chair. That's it from me.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much to the NRC. I think you understand that the process is ongoing. We have mounted your submission. We've got a dilemma now. It's 22:03. We are so late. I'm trying to take the association now of the homeschooling. The kitchen is closing now with 3. So we've got an option of not eating altogether. Oh, we must go quickly eat for 20 minutes and come back. So I plead that let's quickly go eat quickly, like as in quickly,